This is VOA News. I'm Christina Menenti. The Kamala Harris presidential campaign's first video has a pop culture flair. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
Kamala Harris's presidential campaign has rolled out its first video with a pop culture flair.
In this election, we each face a question.
The video underscores a central campaign message about what kind of nation Americans want.
We choose freedom.
Set to a Beyoncé soundtrack, the video is being highlighted on social media as the campaign looks to reach younger voters.
Let's get to work.
Sagar Magani at the White House.
United States President Joe Biden said on Wednesday he pulled out of the race against Republican Donald Trump over concerns about the future of U.S. democracy. Ryan Chang from Reuters has more.
Biden had announced he would exit the race days ago, but this Oval Office address was the first time he's publicly discussed his decision.
I've decided the best way forward is to pass the torch to a new generation. Whether we keep our republic is now in your hands. My fellow Americans, it's been the privilege of my life to serve this nation for over 50 years.
What Biden did not mention was weeks of pressure from within his own party to step aside, which he had resisted until Sunday. That push came after a disastrous performance debating former President Donald Trump. Meanwhile, in the days since Biden's decision, Harris has revitalized the Democratic election campaign. The Democratic National Committee's Rules Committee agreed on a plan to formally nominate Harris as soon as August 1st.
Ryan Chang from Reuters. Bangladesh has said it forgot to remove United Nations markings from vehicles during an army-enforced curfew to contain deadly violence that spread across the country last week and killed nearly 150 people. The United Nations is still waiting for a response. This is VOA News. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports on the arrival of the Palestinian Olympic team to Paris ahead of the Summer Games.
As the Olympic Games prepares to kick off in Paris, the Palestinian Olympic team were given a warm welcome upon their arrival. Well wishers chanted Free Palestine as athletes arrived to a sea of flags and gifts at Paris Charles de Gaulle Airport. The team arrived in the French capital ready to represent war-torn Gaza and the rest of the territories on a global stage. Athletes, French supporters and politicians in the crowd urged the European nation to recognize a Palestinian state. Others expressed outrage at Israel's presence at the Games after UN-backed human rights experts said Israeli authorities were responsible for war crimes and crimes against humanity. I'm Karen Chamas.
Israeli forces retrieved the remains of five Israelis killed during Hamas's October 7th attack on southern Israel, whose bodies had been taken to the Gaza Strip, says Israeli government spokesman David Mentzer.
You may have seen that Israeli security services have retrieved the bodies of five hostages from Hamas captivity. The rescue was carried out yesterday.
The Israeli army said the bodies of Maya Goren, as well as soldiers Tomer Achimas and Kirill Brodsky, along with Ravid Achin, Katz and Oren Golden, military reservists, had been returned to Israel following a rescue operation. Hours before her arrest during a protest in Nairobi on Thursday, Kenyan activist Wanjira Wanjiru called for an end to business as usual in the face of mounting tensions between demonstrators and the government.
The lines are drawn. We are clear. There's the enemies of the people who've united, and there's the people. And now it's a tug of war, and the people have never lost.
The protests, which began peacefully over proposed tax increases, have turned violent in recent weeks. Rights groups report at least 50 deaths nationwide, prompting international concern over police conduct.
We want to say that, honestly, it was not in vain. We will not allow that their death be in vain. We will not allow their opposition to dance on their graves. We will not allow our country to ever go back to the realities that you cannot go out to protest for fear that a bullet might take your life.
The protests have continued despite President William Ruto's withdrawal of the contested legislation and a cabinet reshuffle. Activists maintain calls for systematic changes to address corruption and governance issues at both national and county levels. Argentine President Javier Milei has arrived in Paris, where he is expected to meet French President Emmanuel Macron after tensions escalated between their countries over the soccer team's derogatory post-match chants. I'm Christina Menenti.
It's Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Nothing can come in the way of saving our democracy. That includes personal ambition. So I've decided the best way forward is to pass the torch to a new generation.
That's U.S. President Joe Biden telling the nation why he decided to drop out of the presidential race against former President Donald Trump. Details coming up also. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed a divided U.S. Congress yesterday. And an investigation says the Kremlin has been using the Wagner Group to launder billions of dollars in African gold to help fund its war on Ukraine. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. U.S. President Joe Biden on Wednesday explained to American citizens and to the world why he decided not to stand for re-election in the 2024 presidential race. Biden, speaking from the Oval Office, also outlined what he said was urgent challenges he sees as the nation is heading towards a November vote. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports.
U.S. President Joe Biden made the stunning decision to exit the presidential race from behind a screen, choosing to drop the news online. 3 days later, in an Oval Office speech that was at times hopeful, at times determined, and at times wistful, he explained why. Biden spoke of his 5 decades in public office, touted his presidential record of domestic and political achievements, but then called for energetic new leadership to face tomorrow's challenges.
But nothing can come in the way of saving our democracy. That includes personal ambition. So I've decided the best way forward is to pass the torch to a new generation. That's the best way to unite our nation. You know, there is a time and a place for long years of experience in public life. But there's also a time and a place for new voices, fresh voices, yes, younger voices. And that time and place is now.
Biden also thanked Vice President Kamala Harris, who has taken to the campaign trail with his endorsement and enough delegate pledges to net the nomination. He described her as experienced, tough, and capable, but added, "The choice is up to you." He did not name-check the Republican in the race. But analysts say Biden's stark warnings all point to one man. Jennifer Murcia is a professor of communication and journalism at Texas A&M University.
He talked about polarization. He talked about violence and political violence. Those are all things that harken back to Donald Trump and his presidency. He talked about the threats facing the nation when he first took office, January 2021. And so that was certainly about Donald Trump. But yeah, this wasn't a place for him to talk about Donald Trump. It wasn't a place for him to give a campaign speech.
The president said his job will now focus on domestic challenges like civil rights and voter freedom, gun safety reforms, the quest to end cancer, and Supreme Court reform. He also cited myriad challenges the U.S. faces abroad, with wars raging in Gaza and Ukraine, and China becoming more emboldened in the Indo-Pacific. These foreign fires, analysts say, are likely to burn in the minds of concerned voters. Thomas Schwartz is a history professor at Vanderbilt University.
That's really the concern I think people will have, is how does a lame duck president deal with foreign policy crises?
We'll find out Thursday when Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visits the White House. The Israeli leader is also holding 2 other meetings while in the U.S., with Harris and Trump. But for the final act of this presidency, Biden remains the protagonist on America's biggest stage. Jim Kessler is executive vice president for policy for Third Way.
He's like an athlete that is going to make the Hall of Fame and is retiring and, you know, gets the cheers from the crowds, finally, you know, for a long 50-year tremendous career.
Biden clearly understood that this address would be a dramatic peak. So he used his final words to break the fourth wall with a message as old as America.
Great thing about America is here, kings and dictators do not rule. The people do. History is in your hands. The power is in your hands. The idea of America lies in your hands.
Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed the divided U.S. Congress Wednesday, with many Democratic lawmakers boycotting his speech and protesters surrounding the U.S. Capitol. But congressional Republicans said the speech was key to reaffirming the U.S. commitment to its Middle Eastern ally in the midst of the 10-month-old war with Hamas. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has more.
For the first time since the October 7th Hamas attack that left 1,200 Israelis dead and some 240 hostages captured, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addressed U.S. lawmakers in person Wednesday.
It's a clash between those who glorify death and those who sanctify life. For the forces of civilization to triumph, America and Israel must stand together.
Calling anti-Semitism the world's oldest hatred, Netanyahu spoke directly to protesters.
When the tyrants of Tehran, who hang gays from cranes and murder women for not covering their hair, are praising, promoting, and funding you, you have officially become Iran's useful idiots.
Gaza's health ministry, which does not distinguish civilians from combatants, says more than 39,000 Palestinians have died since the beginning of hostilities. Netanyahu addressed the International Criminal Court's allegations of Israeli war crimes.
Prosecutor of the International Criminal Court has shamefully accused Israel of deliberately starving the people of Gaza. This is utter, complete nonsense.
Several high-profile Democrats, including Vice President Kamala Harris and former Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi, did not attend the speech. Senator Jack Reed, who serves on the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, explained his reasons for boycotting on Tuesday.
Netanyahu's made common cause with far-right extremists who pursue their own agendas at the expense of Israel's security. These extremists have been elevated to some of the highest cabinet positions in the government and have encouraged Netanyahu's most misguided policies.
Netanyahu was welcomed by congressional Democratic and Republican leadership Wednesday. Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson.
This is a very important time. Our bipartisan congressional leadership recognized it as such and invited him here because our dear ally Israel is in an existential fight for its very existence, and that fight extends to every one of its borders.
Some families of Israeli hostages protested the speech, calling on Netanyahu to agree to a U.S. proposed ceasefire. He outlined his own vision for a post-war Middle East.
The day after we defeat Hamas, a new Gaza can emerge. My vision for that day is of a demilitarized and de-radicalized Gaza. Israel does not seek to resettle Gaza, but for the foreseeable future, we must retain overriding security control there.
Netanyahu's address is key to maintaining U.S. support for Israel, but comes at a time when domestic American politics is taking center stage. John Alterman, a fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
He is going to be trying to at least halt an erosion of support among Democrats and try to build credit with Republicans, who he assesses are much more likely to be in power after November elections.
Netanyahu is set to meet with U.S. President Joe Biden and Vice President Harris, as well as former President Donald Trump, later this week. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
An extensive investigation has found that despite international sanctions, the Kremlin has been using the Wagner Group to launder billions of dollars in African gold to help fund its war in Ukraine. It is called blood gold. VOA's Larry London spoke with Jessica Berlin, political analyst and author of the report.
Blood gold refers to gold being smuggled or sold by Russia that they are using to finance their war in Ukraine and also their hybrid warfare activities across the globe. We coined this term to make it easy for people to understand how the gold trade, even if it's illicit business, it's effectively an economic play, but it is directly tied to Russia's violent criminal aggression in Ukraine. This is not only business, it's truly part of how Russia is waging war.
The Blood Gold Report research program launched the investigation in September of last year. My understanding is to investigate the links between Western mining companies and African governments and Russian mercenaries?
That's right. We chose the angle of looking at Western companies' involvement in the blood gold trade because this is one of the areas where Western governments and consumers can have some influence. The things that are revealed in the report are not necessarily new information for players in the industry. However, for most people, for most politicians, a lot of the findings will come as a surprise. So the Blood Gold Report, in this first phase, our goal was to shed light on something that's been happening in the shadows that's been ostensibly legal, but that should be stopped.
What can you tell us about the countries that this involves and what was their strategy and some of the main takeaways?
Our investigation showed that through Wagner Group, Russia has earned over $2.5 billion from the blood gold trade since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine started in February 2022. And let's bear in mind, that's a minimum. That's just the money that could be tracked. It's probably the tip of the iceberg. The report was also only focusing on three countries in Africa where Wagner is active in the gold industry: Central African Republic, Sudan, and Mali. And in these countries, respectively, in CAR, for example, Wagner Group has been given exclusive mining rights for one of the largest gold mines in the country in exchange for giving security services to the ruling regime there. In Sudan, also in a similar way, Wagner Group has control of a gold refinery, which allows them to not only buy local gold, but then to process it. And so they are exporting it, smuggling it out, basically, into international markets. And this is a huge, huge cash cow for them, upwards of 2 billion unreported gold coming out of Sudan every year, with Russia and Wagner Group certainly being a large part of that. And lastly, in Mali, the business model, if we can call it that, is a little bit different. Wagner is essentially being paid a monthly retainer by the ruling junta there. And that money, however, is coming, of course, from state coffers, which are being filled by the taxes paid by Western gold mining companies. So in these three countries, we see different ways how Wagner Group has basically been able to insert themselves into the gold trade, whether illicitly or legally, and sometimes in a hybrid of the two, to make vast profits, declared and undeclared, and take those out of the country. And Wagner is, of course, an operation of the Russian state. And so that money is going back to the Russian Federation and in turn being used to finance Russia's war on Ukraine, as well as their crimes across Africa, in Syria, etc.
That was Jessica Berlin, political analyst and author of a report on Russia's use of African gold, speaking with VOA's Larry London. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The number of people dying due to road accidents in Africa has increased in the past decade, with 250,000 lives lost in 2021 alone, according to the World Health Organization report on Road Safety 2023. The continent recorded an increase of 17% in road-related deaths between 2010 and 2021, despite being home to 15% of the global population and just 3% of its vehicles. The deaths and injuries on African roads are blamed on inadequate road safety and standards, since no African country has laws that meet the best practices and standards like speeding, drunk driving, non-use of motorcycle helmets, seat belts, and child restraints. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
The World Health Organization says road deaths in Africa are becoming a bigger problem compared to other regions of the world. Between 2010 and 2021, road deaths across the continent increased by 20,000. The WHO report released last week conversely shows global road deaths fell by 5% during the same period. Binta Sako is a WHO technical officer. She says the increased deaths are due to a lack of infrastructure and road users' behavior.
First of all, we are a growing population and, you know, urbanization without the infrastructures that follow is one of the reasons. The increased number of vehicles that are unregulated. We are the first importers of used vehicles, and most of the time they're not roadworthy. And then we also have to talk about the behavioral risk factors, you know, about speeding, about drink driving, where we have maybe less regulations around those issues.
Road users like motorcyclists, cyclists and pedestrians are most vulnerable and are at high risk of deaths and injuries. The WHO says the Africa region also has the highest proportion of pedestrian deaths, accounting for one-third of global fatalities. 29-year-old Samuel Amandi lost his brother to a hit-and-run driver in Nairobi.
So, brother, what happened in 2013?
He says my brother was hit by a car in 2013, and his body was found at 5 in the morning by pedestrians. The body was taken to the city mortuary. He says the mortuary followed up with his sister, and that's how we found him. Researchers say no African country has national laws that meet best road practices. TransAid is an international NGO that promotes driver training and government and training programs to improve road safety. Its head officer, Sam Clark, told VOA that training drivers to the required standard helps keep the driver and the other users safe.
You're improving access to training which meets the standard of many of the largest transporters in the industry, and therefore opening up the possibility of improved employment or access to new jobs. But also, by giving them better access to training, we are equipping drivers with a better ability, obviously, to come home safely at the end of every day.
Experts say the underreporting of road injuries and deaths in Africa is another challenge. Police records are a primary source of data collection, but not all road accidents are reported to police. Sako says accurate data on road crashes can help develop targeted responses and prevention efforts.
When we don't have quality data, is we don't understand what is going on. We don't understand why people are dying in the road. What caused those crashes? Is it, you know, is it poor infrastructure? Is it poor lighting? Is it alcohol? You know, is it the use of alcohol? So understanding exactly what is going on, and that is collecting data, so we know who really are the victims, so that we tailor our interventions to make sure that we respond to the needs.
17 countries in Africa have reported reduction in road fatalities, with other countries remaining stagnant or increasing. The UN targets cutting road accident deaths in half by 2030, but at the moment, road safety workers and activists lack the funding and knowledge to make that goal a reality. Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
A group of young African students is shooting for the stars thanks to a program called Pathways to Space. Aerospace company Boeing and a South African science organization backed an education program that just celebrated its first batch of graduates. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town.
Over 300 students from schools in Ethiopia, Nigeria and Tanzania have just finished the 5-month extracurricular Pathways to Space program. In this theoretical and hands-on course, the students built and tested payloads for a high-altitude weather monitoring balloon. The goal was to send up a carton of eggs and have them return to Earth unbroken. Henok Tefera-Scholl is with aerospace company Boeing, the program sponsor. He says he's proud to be involved in space industry education in Africa.
This is a sector that has a potential of transforming our continent, and we're glad to partner with those countries that have launched space programs, such as here in Ethiopia, in Tanzania and in Nigeria.
Shaw says the program had to include 50% girls, and the program will continue to maintain this parity going forward.
And of course, in this area, the participation of girls is very important because they're heavily underrepresented. And we're also happy to see that it was a very diverse set of kids which came from all over Ethiopia.
Girl students like Helena Mulugeta say they love the program and want more opportunities.
I have participated in other programs, but nothing like this, because this has helped me apply the skills I know and the theories that I know. And it has also enhanced my knowledge in the aerospace engineering field and in other parts of space science.
Everyone,
3, 2, 1.
Lift off!
The Ethiopian students marked their graduation with a high-altitude balloon launch from Sulalta, Ethiopia, on July 10. After 5 hours of flight, the balloon landed in Ambo, which is 186 miles west of the launch site. Organizers say all the eggs in the payloads returned uncracked. The Tanzanian and Nigerian graduation ceremonies are scheduled to be held on July 27th, also with high-altitude balloon launches. The program is an initiative of the non-governmental organization Future African Space Explorers STEM Academy, or FASESA. Boeing and FASESA say they will be expanding the Pathways to Space program to other African countries, and starting next year, we'll have both in-person and online training sessions. Vicky Stark, VOA News, Cape Town.
The death toll from landslides in a remote region of southern Ethiopia, according to the United Nations, has risen to 257, warning that the number could soar to up to 500. Rescuers are pressing ahead with a grim search for bodies and survivors in the stricken locality of Kencho Sacha Gozdi, with crowds of distraught locals digging through a sea of mud, often using just their bare hands and shovels. The French news agency AFP says aid has begun arriving in the isolated, hard-to-reach area, including 4 trucks of life-saving supplies from the Ethiopian Red Cross Society. The landslide is the deadliest on record in Ethiopia, Africa's second most populous nation, which is often battered by climate-related disasters. United Nations Chief Antonio Guterres sent his condolences over the disaster, with his spokesman Stephen Dujarric saying he was deeply saddened, adding that UN agencies are dispatching food, nutrition, health and other critical supplies to help people affected by the landslides.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.